This is Jerry Pippin, and we're doing the Phoenix Lights, a special about it, 10 years ago, this month in March. And on the line for Norfolk, we have a fellow who's promoting a conference in Glendale, Arizona, which is right outside Phoenix. And we'll talk about that in a moment. It happens on March 31st and April 1st. William Warwick, when we went to the break, we were talking about all kinds of strange things happening in conjunction with the Phoenix Lights, which to the casual observer would not appear to be connected. But you think somebody needs to connect the dots, as they say. What about President Clinton here? On the surface, it just seems like a random thing that happened at the same time, but maybe not. Tell our audience what stands out about this.
You know, the beautiful thing about this whole case is that you could not write a Hollywood script that would have all the twists and the turns and the intrigue that the real facts have in this case. The Clinton connection to this basically begins with an event that occurred, alleged event that occurred in Hobie Sound at Greg Norman's golf of Greg Norman's house in Florida. At approximately, now the original report that was given to all the news agencies was that President Clinton injured his knee in the wee hours of March 14th, 1997. This would have just been about, you know, 3, 4, maybe 5, 6 hours after the main event. Okay, and after troubleshooters 6515 went down 80 miles off the coast of Norfolk. However, Peter Davenport from Newfork, who was looking, you know, going over some of the information I had on my website, sent me an email on March 13th, the anniversary, right before I got on coast to coast, and informed me that actually the news reports, there are two stories out now. The news story, okay, which is apparently from an interview that Greg Norman gave to Jay Leno on the Tonight Show, is that the events did not happen in the wee morning hours of March 14, 1997. They actually happened at 11:30 p.m. on March 13, 1997. Now, what's absolutely fascinating about this is
well, it'd be 8:30 in Phoenix.
Yeah. Depending on where you are, I'm not sure if that's 2 hours behind or
11:30, 10:30. Well, they don't have daylight savings time. But, of course, they didn't have daylight, so it wasn't as early as it was this year. So you're right, it'd be 9:30.
Right. When you correlate that with the downing of the craft of Troubleshooter 615 at 11:19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on March 13th, and then you've now got Greg Norman coming out in this interview with Jay Leno saying on, you know, television that this happened at 11:30 p.m., that means the 10 minutes after Troubleshooter 6-5 went down, and basically at the very height of the UFO flap in Phoenix, allegedly President Clinton injured his knee and had to be rushed away to the hospital. The scuttlebutt is that, you know, apparently we can only speculate on what happened unless Mr. Clinton feels that he wants to talk to the American public and set the record straight, that something happened in Florida, and apparently, you know, the speculation is that, you know, perhaps the you know, they had their own boomerang experience or a threat, and the Secret Service personnel were rushing President Clinton out to a safe area, Air Force One or whatever they had down there at the time, and he blew his knee out. There are some reports that say he never blew his knee out at all. It was just an excuse to get him out of the public's eye. Under this, you know, alleged knee injury event, so that they could be in hardened bunkers under Bethesda Naval Hospital. You know, the story just gets it's just unbelievable. It just gets more and more.
I heard that there was a DEFCON 2 alert. In the first place, what is that?
DEFCON 3, actually, is what it was.
Okay.
According to Bill Hamilton and his sources, Spacecom, which, again, is in Colorado, very near where, in the vicinity of where Craig Button allegedly crashed his airplane, Spacecom issued a Defense Condition Readiness 3 alert, which put the whole United States military on a sort of a defensive status, you know, anticipating some type of attack. At the same time, and this has been confirmed, Spectrum Astro, I believe it's in Chandler, Arizona, a satellite manufacturer of the MISTI-3 satellite, which is a U.S. Air Force satellite, was disabled by an object which apparently was hovering over it, some type of object drained its batteries. And the interesting thing about it is that the manufacturer protested that the military, they have a miracle laser that they were developing at the time. The U.S. Army wanted to test fire that laser on this satellite. The manufacturer said, you know, what are you doing? There's nothing wrong with this satellite. The batteries are dead. Would you fire it back up? Which is telling, because maybe there was something on the satellite that was seen that the Army didn't want anybody to see. There's no other reason to destroy a multi-million-dollar satellite just to test fire a laser.
When we talk about these incidents, there were a lot of things that happened on the 14th, too. For instance, the HAARP, they stopped their test or shut it down or something?
Yeah, you know, it just gets better and better. Okay, as you listeners probably all know, the HAARP stands for High Altitude Auroral Research Project in Gakona, Alaska. This was a ionospheric heater research project, which has other applications, speculated by many. But basically, they had developed the program, which is ramping up to a full-size test and deployment of this system. But at the time, in 1997, they had just finished what was called the DP, the developmental prototype. Okay, so the HAARP DP developmental prototype, which is about a quarter size of the full HAARP facility and the antenna systems and stuff like that, went online on February 28, 1997, and went offline on March 14, 1997.
Well, now the U.S. Air Force, they stood down for 48 hours that same time period. Or is that true? Or am I just listening to scuttlebutt that's not backed up?
You're right, but it didn't happen in February. It happened on September 16, 1997. There was three plane crashes in a row. I believe one of them was, I think it was a C-130, collided with a German plane in the middle of the Atlantic. Now, let's think about that for a second, okay? The Atlantic's pretty big.
Yeah, right, and how could they find each other?
Right, and with another country, and then they just happened to crash into each other. And there were two other crashes that happened. In addition to, if you recall, the Baltimore crash of the F-117 stealth fighter bomber, whose wing apparently just snapped off. Well, the scuttlebutt is that it actually hit a cloaked vehicle.
Probably a UFO.
Yes, and there was a lot of evidence. In fact, I have an article from a pilot who took a picture. His name was David Hastings in 1985 of a boomerang-shaped object. It was published in UFO Magazine UK, which is on my website, who basically, you know, felt, or out of the corner of his eye, saw something coming over him over the Mojave Desert where he was flying over with them in a Skymaster. Couldn't see the object, got his camera out, took two or three photographs. On one photograph, there is a huge black boom. You can't tell it's boomerang shaped because it's going away from the pilot who's taking the picture, okay? But if you look at the way that the air molecules are going over, you know, the middle of the craft and the refraction of the light off the left and right wings, it's a boomerang-shaped craft, exactly the same size, exactly the same dimensions, exactly the same shape as the craft that I saw in Norfolk, okay? But these guys couldn't see it, okay? It only showed up on the camera.
Yeah, kind of like that story down in Mexico where things showed up on infrared and nothing else.
Ah, this brings us back to Troubleshooter 615, okay? The theory that I have about 615 is when the helicopter was coming in to land on the frigate, there was a boomerang that was shadowing the frigate, and they didn't see it till the very last second because they were coming on approach, everything was fine. At the very last second, they were 40 or 50 feet above the deck, they were higher than normal. They waved off, they did what's called a rotation, and they slammed into the ocean, head nose first, right off the starboard bow of the frigate. failure. They did an autopsy. There were no drugs. There was no medical problems, no heart attack, nothing. So what I believe happened on March 13, 1997, is that that troubleshooter 615 craft was coming in for a landing on final approach, and who knows what it was doing. Allegedly, it dropped off a SEAL team crew, a four-man SEAL team that was heading back to the carrier, stopping at the frigate for a refuel. The infrared thing is important to understand because from a satellite, if this boomerang-shaped object was traveling sideways, from every indication, it needs to go upside, up, you know, up, down, left, right, backwards, forwards, and it can go in any direction it wants to. It has, you know, 9 degrees of freedom or 10 degrees of freedom, however you want to look at it. If one of those boomerang-shaped objects was hovering above the frigate, first of all, the frigate's radar is pointed to the horizon. It's not pointed straight up, okay? Second of all, from all indications, these things are completely visible to radar. So even if they could see it from a radar that's pointing straight up, which they don't have, they wouldn't see it. However, from a satellite like the Misty 3, if you were looking down, all you would see is the heat signature that would be coming from the frigate, or the heat signature that you would think was coming from the frigate but was really coming from the boomerang-shaped object. So from all indications, I'm going to guess that these objects are invisible to radar, but they are not invisible to infrared or other forms of electromagnetic detection.
There was a gamma ray burst at the same time.
Yeah, the gamma ray burst correlates with the beginning of the HARP ED experiment. On February 28, 1997, there was the first ever optical transient picture, and what that means is the gamma ray bursts occur a couple times a day. They release more energy than us. Some in a few seconds, they release more energy than a whole summer release in its whole lifetime. And on February 28, 1997, for the first time in history, scientists were able to get what's called an optical transient, which is just a picture of the actual light that was coming from from the gamma ray burst. Now, interestingly enough, this was taken on March 13, 1997. It was published in the July edition of Scientific America. And the exact quote, I believe, said that it is a mysterious oblong object, which is between the source of the gamma ray burst and the satellite, which and the Hubble Space Telescope, which was taking this picture, and they had no idea what it was.
We have lots of things to think about here, William, and we still have a quarter hour to go.
I can't believe this is the fastest I've ever gone through this.
We're talking I feel like you're a good friend, even though we just met recently.
Yeah, well, you know, it's birds of a feather flock together, Jerry.
William Hamilton, he's weighed in on this several times. And you're not the only one saying things like this.
No, in fact, Mike Fortson just told me today that there was a meteorologist, Schnabel, I believe, in Phoenix, who came to him and told him about the gamma ray burst. And what's very interesting about this, I've talked to Mike, you know, a lot of these things that I'm talking about have not gone unnoticed by the witnesses. And it's very almost eerily and uncannily reminiscent of some sort of, I don't even know how to explain it.
Yes.
I want to say psychic experience.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. Do you recall Close Encounter?
Sure.
Okay. Do you recall when they're in the trailer there with, you know, the guy that's supposed to be playing Jacques Vallée and Richard Dreyfuss gets in there and he's just pissed off as hell? You know, the government has no right to do this. You know, you can't keep this from us, blah, 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 blah. And then Richard Dreyfuss gets taken off to the helicopter where they, you know, get taken off and degassed or whatever. And I'll never forget this. And this is how I can describe this whole Phoenix Lights event and how it relates to my Norfolk incident. It's an event sociological. It's a sociological event, okay? The government has no right to stop what's happening. And I don't think they can even if they wanted to. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why they're freaking out about this and they want to keep it suppressed.
Well, I think you're right about that. William Warwick, we'll be right back.
Do you have a problem with mold or mildew in your home? Well, listen to this. We have found a product you will love. Moldzyme, an effective non-toxic mold and mildew cleaner. Moldzyme is the cleaner, greener way to remove mold and mildew stains. This is a line of completely non-hazardous, non-toxic, and environmentally safe products. Gets rid of mold and mildew stains quickly, easily, and safely. Moldzyme contains no chlorine or ammonia, is non-hazardous and hypoallergenic, safe on wood, concrete, and brick, inside or outside your home. Moldzyme eliminates odors and is fragrance-free, an all-natural and environmentally safe way to remove mold and mildew stains that really work. See the complete line of products by clicking on one of the Moldzyme banners located throughout our website. You'll be glad you did.
The Phoenix Lights Conference will get underway on March 31st and April 1st. William Warwick is our guest, and you're more than just a concert promoter. Well, you know, when I say that, and you make a joke about the concert promoter, this is true. You could make more money than you can with a UFO convention.
I am... God, are you kidding me? I think that...
But I have a hunch you're not in it for the money.
I have a very successful design build architectural firm here in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I have a real job. You know, we do contracting, we build houses, you know, we get our hands dirty, you know, and people trust us to do, you know, $200,000-$400,000 room additions. So, you know, the fact that I'm... Yeah, the answer to your question is there's no money in this. I'm putting $20,000 out to invest to, you know, to get everyone to come down. I also want to say that everyone that's involved in this, in terms of the speakers that are coming, like Francis Barwood and Mike Fortune, no one is being paid for this. Okay, this is a total volunteer effort. I think it separates this from all the other UFO conferences. I mean, I've had people call me like, you know, I really want to go, but I went to a UFO conference last month and I fell asleep. Okay, well, this isn't what this is going to be like. Okay, I'm just a regular guy. I got two kids. I just took my son back from soccer. You know, I'm a baseball coach, you know, and I'm just like 99% of probably everyone else out there listening to this show right now. But I had an extraordinary experience, and I cannot stand the fact, and so did thousands of other people in Phoenix and around the world, and I just cannot stand the fact the government is lying to us and making us all look like fools. And if it happened to you, if it happened to your brother or your father or your sister or your mother, and you knew what they went through and the anguish that they went through, okay, you would support them 100%. And that's all I'm trying to do for my fellow witnesses that I don't know, that I've never met. That's all I'm trying to do.
Now, we've mentioned all the coincidences, or most of them. There are probably others.
Oh, if you believe in coincidences.
Well, yeah, we can debate that if we want. But for showbiz purposes here on our radio program, we're going to call it that. You know, and in other words, there were lots of incidents that may be related. How is that?
You know, I take that back. I'm a little fired up right now. But, yeah, what I do is I'm an investigative journalist in my part-time. That's kind of what, you know, and this is not the only story.
Well, I can tell you that as an investigative journalist myself. And you know that. You follow the trail. One thing leads to another.
You follow the lead wherever it goes. You know, you don't dismiss anything. You follow it wherever it goes. And if it goes someplace that people don't think, oh, wow. You know,
one thing that being a nuts and bolts guy, a realist, I had a long time coming to the conclusion or admitting that there seems to be a spiritual and religious element to this UFO stuff too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And in fact, talking to you, you brought up Edgar Cayce.
Sure. Oh, God. Yeah, the connection between my sighting and Edgar Cayce was really something that I stumbled upon. I mean, literally just kind of fell over. This is very complicated. I'm not sure that we can get through this. But basically what happened is I came across a book published in 1969 by a New Zealander by the name of Bruce Cathy. He had some UFO sightings. He was also a pilot, by the way, okay? A qualified observer, and he had some UFO sightings in New Zealand, and basically he did some studying and some research, and he correlated the sightings and where they were going and where they were coming from. He found a pattern, okay? And he came up with this theory that the UFOs were following what he called a global grid, okay? Which was what's called a hyperdimensional force, okay, for lack of a better term, that these UFOs were using to traverse around the atmosphere of the Earth. And one of the stories that he had published in this book called Harmonic Conquest of Space was that his research had found that that the Russians, who did a lot of investigation into psychic energies and stuff like that, he found that they would place their psychics in certain geometric configurations so that their powers would be enhanced. And he speculated that Edgar Casey, who was born in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, at 36 degrees, 51 degrees latitude, north latitude, or 55, I apologize, had traveled all around the country looking for a place where his psychic energies told him was the right place to settle. The last place that he was at before he moved to Virginia Beach was in Dayton, Ohio, which of course is where the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is now, except he was there in 1925. And he had had a reading that told him that and this is 1925 language, okay, that the energies in Virginia Beach would be like electricity that would pass easier over iron than it would over glass, okay? And there's more than I've got some of the reference material inside the inside of my book, but basically what Edgar Casey was saying in 1925 during this reading was that, you know, Virginia Beach was a special place, and not just anywhere in Virginia Beach, but according to the book that Kathy published, that Edgar Casey moved to the exact same latitude that he was born at.
Yeah.
Indicating that there may be something to the geometric or the geographic, certain geographic locations that would allow some of these tests to take place. Okay? Now here's where it gets really interesting. I said, okay, fine. So what I did is I went out and I got a GPS receiver, because I was curious, because it was the latitude where the Casey Center was that was published in Kathy's book was very near the latitude that I had had my UFO encounter. And I said, well, you know, let's just see if there's a connection.
And now your UFO encounter was when you were
March 12, 1997, was 26.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure we're talking about the same
thing. Yeah. So I got this GPS receiver, and I went to go check Kathy's work. Well, lo and behold, what do I find out? Kathy published the wrong coordinates. He was off by 3 degrees. Now, 3 degrees may not seem like a lot, but 3 degrees in terms of actual, you know, miles, it's, you know, 3 or 4 miles, I think. You know, so it's quite a bit off, considering the fact that you can open up an ADC map and know exactly the latitude and longitude of where the Edgar Casey Center is on 67th Street in Virginia Beach, right? So I thought, well, this is really weird. So I contacted Bruce Caffey. I wrote him a letter, and I said, listen, I'm not trying to, you know, rain on your parade or anything, but did you know that your coordinates were off, right? Well, he didn't like that too much, and he wrote me back a nasty email. And I said, listen, I'm not trying to disprove you, okay? I think that you're onto something here. And he basically said, go back and look at the book. I went back and looked at the book, and in the chapter where he writes about Edgar Casey, immediately after he gives the latitude, right, he writes something to the effect of, I had published this in my previous book, but the government maybe, you know, took the book off the stands, and now I can publish it again. And I thought about that. I thought, well, that's kind of weird. You know, why would the government want him to take his books off the stands and then republish it again? And then, boom, it dawned on me, they made him change his coordinates. All right? So, and then I sent him another email stating that's what I thought, and then he kind of, you know, he warmed up a little bit. He said, yeah, that's basically what happened. So, the new coordinates, 36 degrees, 55 minutes north, 43 seconds north, okay, down to the second, which is about 30 feet, by the way. 30 by 30 foot section is the second. And what I found, you're not going to believe this, is that Bruce Caffey, in the very next chapter, after Edgar Casey, gives the latitude for what he calls a possible harmonic experiment site, okay? Well, that latitude that he lists as 36 degrees, 55 minutes, 43 seconds north is exactly the same latitude where I saw my boomerang at Norfolk in 1997.
Wow.
Yeah.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I've left out one thing, a phenomenon, I guess, is what I need to talk about, that is connected to the Phoenix Lights.
And I don't mean to cut you off, Jerry, but there's a lot more to the Edgar Cayce thing that I could really show.
Oh, well, sure. I know. And you're going to do a little PowerPoint presentation about that, I think.
PowerPoint presentation, I guarantee you, will blow you away.
And that'll be at the conference itself.
Yep.
The Hale-Bopp Comet. We only have a couple of minutes left. That was the reason most of these people saw this thing, right? They were out looking for the Hale-Bopp.
That's correct. Watching the Hale-Bopp Comet, which is a long period comet. I have some of the research that I've done says that this comet was here in 2200 BC, I believe is what it was. And there's a stella called the Narum Stella, which shows two objects. The interesting thing about that is that, if you recall, Hale-Bopp, when it came, there was the whole controversy about it having a possible companion, quote-unquote. And, of course, if you remember the Heaven's Gate cult that committed suicide on March 27th, 1997, just a few weeks after the Phoenix Lights, they're the ones that said that there was a UFO behind the comet as well, which kind of gave it a whole fringe element that probably it really didn't need to have.
Yeah, we could talk about a lot of other things. One of my favorite coincidences or events or something that's synchronistic is the idea that Federico Pena was appointed to Department of Energy as the head of it.
From the reports that I've read, Federico Pena was swiftly approved and appointed to be the new Secretary of the Defense of, Department of Energy. He was approved on March 12th, and he took office on March 13th, 1997, and he gave a closed circuit speech to all DOE employees on that morning.
In the morning of the Phoenix Lights that evening.
That's right, in the morning at 10 a.m., I believe. The scuttlebutt with that, of course, is that, you know, UFO researchers have been saying that the Department of Energy has been the organization within the United States government that handles all alien or UFO-related subjects, so... you've got a changing of the guards, so to speak, taking place.
Right.
On March 13th, again,
We have 30 seconds left. William, give us a little commercial for your conference.
If you have seen the Phoenix Lights or the boomerangs, and you're a witness to these events in Phoenix, please come to this conference. This conference is for you. You will have a chance to have your testimony videotaped. We will take all of the testimony that we get. It will be delivered, hand-delivered by myself and my executive producer to the National Archives in Washington, whether they want it or not. And this is your chance to tell your story and let the world know what really happened in Phoenix.
Now, you have a book out?
I put the book off.
Okay.
The money that I was going to use to publish the book, I decided to put it off until after the conference, but I concluded.
So you put the money into the conference.
Correct.
Watch out for a book coming out one of these days by William Warrick. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is Jerry Pippin, our producer, of course, for this show, and post-production editor is Jane Swartley. Until next time. Cheers.
The year was 1970 when Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan released their first big single hit, Tennessee Birdwalk. For the first time in the history of music, this 45 RPM single becomes available to the public in the form of a mouse pad. Made of high-quality quarter-inch rubber, this fabric-covered 8-inch mouse pad delivers your mouse a very smooth ride. For only $9.95 plus $2.50 shipping and handling, your mouse pad will be rushed via USPS first-class mail. Simply click on the happy little mice and be directed to our ordering page. Hurry while this limited time offer lasts.